You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My podcast today is with Ravin Jesuthasan. Ravin is a recognized futurist and authority on the future of work, human capital, and automation. He's a senior partner and global leader for transformation services at Mercer and a member of the World Economic Forum's Steering Committee on Work and Employment. He's the author of 6 books, and his latest is The Skills-Powered Organization. This was a fascinating read, and I think it's a really good conversation. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The coil of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Ravin Jesuthasan, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you, Kelly. It's lovely to be here.
So the first line in the introduction to your new book is, quote, "We create boxes to make sense of the world," end quote. And this concept comes up a lot in this podcast because improvisation is a practice in out-of-box thinking. But in the case of this book, you were trying, in a non-alarmist fashion, to wake the world up to the fact that the very structures and systems of how we have worked for the last 140 years is changing. It has changed, and it won't be going back. Is that a fair summation?
That is an absolutely fair summation. And maybe a little bit of context for your listeners, Kelly, on this book, because it's my 6th book. And the previous 5 really went about building the case for how work was changing. So my 2nd book, which was called Lead the Work, Navigating a World Beyond Employment, built the case for why work needed to escape the traditional confines of organization structures. And it was written in 2012 as we were starting to see the rise of the gig economy with platforms like Upwork and Tongle in the creative space, et cetera. And then Reinventing Jobs delved deep into the impact of AI and process automation on work and how that was starting to fundamentally deconstruct and redeploy work well before we had ChatGPT. That was in 2018. And then Work Without Jobs laid all of this out as an operating system for organizations to think about the more agile combination of talent, technology, in pursuit of the organization. And what this book really does is build on those, certainly those last 3, and accelerate it even further to think about how do we move beyond those boxes, those jobs where we had those one-to-one relationships, right, between a degree, a person, and a position, to the many-to-many, between skills and work. The smaller building blocks of skills, the unique bundle of skills that's Kelly versus Ravin.
Yeah.
And how those skills might be deconstructed, combined, redeployed at scale and speed as we increasingly have to build a workforce, not just for just in time, but increasingly for just in case.
So it was interesting. I was finishing this book in the airport in Nashville. I'd gone there for the weekend to meet, and there couldn't be anything more opposite than me wandering the streets of Nashville in this book. But what struck me was it's not uncomplex, but what is seemingly very important is radical, which is seeing the world differently. It is, you talk a lot about deconstruction. Let's deconstruct this so that we can ask a question that we would never even consider asking in the normal sense. And I found that kind of fascinating, of course, because of our work. And I'm curious, in the course of these last 6 books, right, how much is your vision from, you know, whatever, 10 years ago to where we are now shifted, changed, morphed, or has it progressed in a way you kind of sensed that it was going to go?
That's a really good question, Kelly. I would actually say it has, it's been a bit of both in the sense that, you know, that longer term vision has been steadily reinforced with progressive rounds of research that have gone into these books over the last, you know, coming on 13 years. But one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book with my co-author was, you know, she's a practitioner, right? She's the chief strategy and chief talent officer at a 170-year-old organization that, you know, operates in many different parts of the world. And actually working alongside her to pivot the battleship, right? These large established organizations where you've got these deep legacies of routines and culture. You know, my friend Gary Bowles talks about skill set, mindset, and tool set. And I think it absolutely encompasses, you know, those things that shape an organization and its culture. But pivoting the way people think about work and doing two things fundamentally differently, right? And we talk about this in the book, bending the demand curve of work in a fundamentally different way, because every organization is going to need to increasingly decouple future growth from resource intensity. Mm-hmm. And you can't just keep flogging the horse, right? You need something fundamentally different. You need to bend the demand curve of work in a fundamentally different way in order to get to the sorts of outcomes we're looking for. But equally, how do we bend the supply curve of work in a different way to make work so much more accessible to all of the different people who could contribute to the mission? And, you know, you've probably heard the acronym STARS, right? People who are skilled through alternative routes. And that's one of the things, one of the great societal benefits we've seen from organizations who are becoming skills powered, as like Standard Chartered Bank, the accessibility to disadvantaged communities, you know, to work in the organization by eliminating degree requirements, by connecting, being really explicit about what skills do we need for the work and who has the skills or who could acquire the skills and contribute tomorrow. And I think that's where we start to, again, bend the supply and demand curve of work in fundamentally different ways for both organizational and broader societal benefit.
Since we're just using the audio, we don't use the video here, I want to explain the fact that I'm reaching behind me to take a thing off my bulletin board, which is two quotes from Gary Bowles that when I interviewed him that I just kept up there. I remember this, but I don't remember what the quotes are. So I'm going to read you the quotes. One is, think of problem solving as a mindset and a skill set enabled by a constantly changing tool set. Love that. That's a good one. And then the other ones is quote, games are not only problem solving situations. They also have the incentives for solving the problem baked into them, delivering pain for losing and pleasure for winning in a range of contexts. So not unconnected to what you talk about in the book, because this is, I mean, we're talking about this idea of, okay, here's one, is the fact that, you know, I might tell you, here's my six skill sets, but what you understand and what AI can help us with is understand that I'm shorting myself, that I likely have 25 skill sets. So this, for those folks who are scared of AI, and I understand, I work in the creative arts, I totally understand that. There's this other aspect of it that is enabling. And I think the vision you paint is one in which it's this lovely synchrony between humans and machines that holds the greater promise for us going forward in our places of work.
Yep. Absolutely, Kelly. And firstly, I love those two quotes from Gary. I've heard them before, and he's such a brilliant man. You're absolutely right. You know, and you're alluding, Kelly, to, you know, one of the experiments we referenced in the book, right? Where at the World Economic Forum, we asked people to tell us the skills they had, and the average, and this was in a prototype in the consumer goods sector. The average person came up with a list of seven, almost all the technical skills, you know, that we all over-indexed to. And then when we had the algorithm go infer skills, from their previous work history, from the teams they'd worked on, from the education they'd gotten. The average list was close to 28. And I think that's where the power of AI, right, you know, appropriately harnessed, it can be a real asset in not just doing work itself, but also in terms of better helping us better understand who we are, mm-hmm. and how we can sort of actually contribute to work today, as well as the things we could easily learn that we may not even be aware of because of the skill adjacencies that underpin, you know, those other types of work. I think that's where we are truly on that journey of seeing the machine augmented or AI augmented business operating model. But also, you know, I think undeniably, like it or not, and it won't be easy, but the AI augmented workforce and you know, human experience.
Yeah, there's an example that you cite, which I thought was made me think about this differently, is in chapter 4. And it's an example of like a product designer. And do you know what I'm referring to in terms of that?
Yeah.
Can you talk us through that? Because I think that's kind of a lovely way for people to be like, oh, this is how that might work.
Yeah. So is this, so we have a couple of examples. Is this?
It's deconstructing the tasks and the idea of the framing of the question, can volunteer focus groups do the job of a product designer? Which, of course, you would say no to.
Yeah.
But you do this other thing and you recognize that, oh, maybe the question is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So in maybe a little bit of context for the listeners. Yeah. So one of the key things about skills is the opportunity we have to really understand what are the activities that we do and the skills required to do those activities, right? Whether those are technical skills or what we call human skills, you know, critical thinking, the expression of empathy, care and concern, et cetera. And in the book, in the example, if I'm remembering it correctly, we talk about very often when you've got where you started, right? When if you've got a box and you say, well, this is the job of a designer and no one else could do that. But when you deconstruct that work into all of its elements, right? And what you start to see are some activities associated with research, some activities associated with like data gathering, some activities associated with analyzing different options, other activities associated with actually doing design and testing it. And what you start to see is the potential for talent with different expertise organized in different ways to actually contribute to each of those, because you're not now thinking of resourcing the box. You've pulled the box apart into all of its elements and kind of opened the aperture. And what you might start to see now is, well, actually, you know what, in terms of the development of different design options, I could get a much better outcome if I crowdsource that from a bunch of people with non-traditional experience. And in fact, I'll give you an example that was really eye-opening for us. And this was in that second book, Lead the Work, Navigating a World Beyond Employment. At the University of Washington, this is pretty old. This is going back to about 2011. But they were trying to basically come up with a methodology to sort of fold the HIV protein, right? And as to find ways to sort of tackle that in terms of, you know, what drugs could be attached to it. And they had spent years, you know, with the usual scientists trying to get people to sort of figure out different ways of folding the protein. And what they did, and this goes back to Gary's example of a game, they actually turned the problem over to a bunch of video gamers. And literally in the space of something like 72 hours, these kids, most of them were kids, had figured out exactly how to fold the protein. They'd figured out different permutations, different ways of combating the problem, because the researchers, you know, stumped for years, said, let's turn it over to a non-traditional talent pool, someone who's going to bring true out-of-the-box thinking, but also people who have a set of skills at tackling problems in a fundamentally different way than how we've been doing it. And that, to me, was just really eye-opening. We had another example of Siemens turning to Disney to help with the marketing of a children's hearing aid. And it was such a brilliant idea, because Siemens obviously developed a world-class hearing aid because of their engineering prowess, but knows nothing about selling to children. And who knows about selling to children? Who knows more about, you know, selling to children than Disney? Mm-hmm. And so actually going to them to say, why would you take this to market? And this thing takes off because it's packaged with Mickey in a way that it took away the stigma to kids of wearing a hearing aid. It actually became cool wearing a hearing aid in kindergarten. And but I think that's where, and it's what I, you know, you talked about the connections to improv, Kelly. I think that's really where you start to see the synergy, right? Of just stepping back, thinking outside of the box and opening the aperture as to how different skills could solve different types of problems.
Yeah, because, you know, we do it here in a couple different ways, which I think is what you're talking about. So one is it's sort of peer-to-peer. We have to learn this improv to be able to co-create together. But then we involve the audience. And that's, you know, that what's so funny about that, I used to use the term years ago, like, oh, we're like a Nielsen rating system because we go to the audience. And but I didn't have any idea how prescient this was going to be with regard to, oh, no, this is how everything is made now in terms of rapid prototyping in front of audiences. We started in 1959 when we didn't even know what I don't even know that anyone knew what rapid prototyping was, you know, back then. Right. So Standard Charter, which is your co-author's company, is this correct in terms of how they use this, which is people still have their jobs. They come in, they have that up. But then there is an element of skills that the company is aware of that they can be assigned to various tasks or programs. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is an important point, actually, that you're raising, Kelly, because in the legacy model, all work is done in jobs, right? You know, yeah. I'm an accountant. I show up and I do accounting things from 9 to 5, and then I go home and I come back tomorrow and do more accounting things. Yeah. Well, now what you're starting to see as the demands of agility increase, because the world we live in is exponentially more volatile and moves with much greater velocity than ever before. We now have, you know, new technological tools. We have new challenges as a society, the climate crisis, the energy crisis, needing to deal with the geopolitical crises, the opportunities that AI affords. What you're starting to see are three very nuanced models of work emerge. So certainly you still have the need for those fixed jobs, right? And increasingly companies saying, we're going to really focus on those fixed jobs where there is a heavy control imperative, where we're regulated. You know, my pilot at United Airlines, I would like her to be doing that job full time because there is such a premium on her competence. And the company, you know, generates value as she progressively acquires the competence to fly bigger planes, right? Because that's how they make money. So that's that fixed role. But more and more organizations are moving from what we call from that fixed role to flexible roles. Flexible roles are where you and I might be in a job, but we have the flexibility to express our skills in different domains. So if I'm a data scientist sitting in IT, I might take on a project with finance to develop a new planning application because that's my skills are being deployed to, you know, in a different domain, but I'm expressing the skills that I have. Or I might work with HR to design a workforce planning application because that's where my skills are needed. Equally, companies are also saying, we want to give people the opportunity to acquire new skills by taking on a project. You know, Ravin and Kelly collaborating will teach Ravin a few things, and he's going to learn some different things as he works alongside Kelly and a bunch of other people solving a different problem. He may not have the domain expertise or the technical skills, but he's got adjacent skills. And so this is where you start to see this hybrid state of both jobs and skills being the currency for work. And then the last model is what we call the flow model. And I think of this as agile on steroids, basically. Yeah. This is where people might be notionally in a job, but they're connecting to work through projects and gigs. So this is where when we've got scarce skills in organizations, data scientists, scrum masters, program managers, we need them across the enterprise. And more companies are saying, you know what, we don't want them bound up in like the IT function. We're going to put them into an agile talent pool, and they're going to connect to work through projects and assignments and gigs. And that's where having all three models in play really puts a premium on that, you know, skill set, mindset, and tool set, right, of leaders, because no longer can I default to a one-size-fits-all solution. I now have to have a fit-for-purpose operating model across all three, because all three are going to exist. And knowing which model to tap, you know, for different types of work is going to be increasingly important.
So there are two areas right away that I look at when I consider this model, and certainly this has come up when the concept of the gig economy started. And when I was in Nashville visiting my 27-year-old son, who is a Shakespearean actor who works at a taco place on the side, right? So it's insurance, it's healthcare, and it's savings, retirement, that sort of thing. We have to fix that. That right? Yeah. That is seemingly those two things are, because this 140-year-old model is those things are together. That's how you live life, and it's just not working like that anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where the CARES Act, for the first time, right? You know, we saw benefits being extended to non-job holders, right? Gig workers, etc. And I am hopeful. Progress has somewhat stalled, to be honest, right? I was really hopeful that we would start to, for want of a better phrase, Kelly, find a third way. Yeah. Right? And what I mean by that is, you know, where you're either employee or not, right? You're either protected or not. Because all of our social constructs, particularly in this country, right, are mm-hmm. so dependent on someone being in a job. And we absolutely need to decouple from that, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we're starting to see some good experiments in different parts of the world, in different states. So Washington State introduced this notion of, you know, fractional accounts, right? So if I'm a gig worker, you know, my income is not steady, but every time I give someone an Uber ride, there is a fraction of the fee that is added to an account that I can control, right? That can be used on a tax advantage, at least state tax advantage basis, for retirement, for healthcare, or for education. And I think, you know, think of if we could do something like that on a national basis, right? In large part, the Affordable Care Act was a big step in that direction, right?
Yeah.
Of starting that decoupling. Hope springs eternal, right? That we won't keep turning our back on progress. But I do think we have to get there, Kelly. And, you know, in the book, we write about what some other countries are doing, you know, what France is doing with their personal accounts. I've worked with the Singapore government. I've got teams working with the governments in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, all of whom are thinking about how do we create more flexible, you know, societal constructs to enable the transition of skills across industries at scale and speed? Because we need to ensure that people have the flexibility to move much more quickly. If you think of the Middle East, moving people from traditional extractive industries like oil and gas into tourism is a really big thing. So giving people the space and the resources to upskill and reskill. You know, in Singapore, their Skills Future initiative, people get a stipend to go reskill. So that stipend can be used for childcare while they're acquiring new skills. Their employer gets a tax credit for giving the person the time and the space to reskill. So that's like, you know, it's sort of a win-win, right? And again, I just worry, certainly with what many people don't know, the Inflation Reduction Act actually mm-hmm. did a ton of good on creating the new skills, you know, reskilling people for the new technologies associated with dealing with climate change. But it's just, you know, the tip of the iceberg as to what's really required. And I suspect, you know, President Biden would have gone a lot further if there was, you know, certainly the support for that. But the fact that he even got it through to begin with was you know, yeah. quite the miracle. But again, I think there is just such a need for us to radically rethink our social safety nets in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And we're having the wrong arguments, right? And you talk in the book that we lack a common knowledge. We lack a schema understanding, you know, what's necessarily in front of us and to get to the right arguments, you know, so like let's stop having the big government, little government. Government is part of this. It is. We are all part. There are many different audiences. There are, and you also talk in the book, and this is a huge thing for improvisation, the need to experiment over and over and over again, try different things, see how they work. That is the only way that we progress. And we learn from our failures. We don't learn that much from our successes. So you have to bake in, and this is the yes and thing, right? Which is like early stage ideation. That is yes and. It's about early, lots of abundant amount of ideas that then you kind of pare down. But people always want to go to perfect. And exactly. I think you can say it, there is no perfect. There's no utopia.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the key here is, you know, it's how do we fail fast, right? How do we rapidly iterate? How do we fail fast and learn from it? And you're right. We are much better at learning from our failures because, you know, once bitten, twice shy, right? You know what? Mm-hmm. Tried that, didn't work. Let me try something else. And as opposed to, you know, we're going to be winning all the time and out of the gate, you know, that winning is preordained and it's an embarrassment if we don't win. You know, that's not reality at all. And we see that in companies all the time, right? The ones who have these highly risk-averse cultures where people are penalized for doing anything that, you know, that is viewed as a failure. Those organizations, yeah, they might be profitable today, but they're just shrinking their way to greatness versus the ones who create the space, who allow for these sort of constructive failures, where failures are recognized and rewarded and become building blocks for what they try next. Those are the ones who really grow and grow exponentially and grow their profits exponentially.
My office is one office away from our head of people, our HR person. And I often will go in there and like read her passages from a book I'm reading for upcoming. I actually left the book with her at her request. And I want to talk a bit about this because there's a clarion call here for us to be, I'm going to say the word weaponizing in a positive way, HR, needing them to be leaders, recognizing that this idea of human performance and skills lay at the center of all this, which means that the organization itself needs to be sort of have that people center thing, which is fairly rare in most organizations, I'd say.
Yep. Oh, I absolutely. You know, we in the book, we have a whole chapter on, you know, what this means for the profession formerly known as HR, because HR has gotten such a bad rap for so long, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a profession that its legacy was kind of in what one of my clients calls, you know, ensuring the silent running of the enterprise, right? Ensure I've got enough people with the right skills available at the right time and at the right cost, and I'm not going to get sued, right? Yeah. To increasingly, I think, and I've written at length about this in my work with the World Economic Forum, this shift from HR being a steward of employment, you know, ensuring the silent running, to becoming a steward of work and ensuring that the organization has the right combinations of resources, ensuring that the evolving demand for work is truly understood in a timely and rigorous fashion, that the response to getting that work done is a combination of process automation, AI, and talent, whether that's an employee or otherwise, and ensuring that that employee experience is one that is as accessible as possible. So, you know, as I said earlier, the bending of the demand curve of work and the bending of the supply curve, and it requires a radically different HR function, you know, one that is, you know, truly having a seat at the CEO's right hand, because he or she, as the CHRO, the chief people officer, is helping the business orchestrate work and the human experience of work.
It's interesting, though, when you think about what that might look like, I just, in my mind, I'm like, wow, that is the rare position in a company where you'd have like a poet and a computer scientist.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? No, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is truly requiring, you know, some new capabilities, right? There's a lot more data science that's coming into HR, but the ability to motivate change, to tell stories, right?
Stories.
Motivate people to change. you know, is the second half of that equation, right? Because just the data is insufficient, right? The ability to sort of use it to change behavior and decision-making is absolutely paramount.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before that, you had a line. It's a quote from Lina Nair, who is now the CEO of Chanel, who said, culture is the new structure. Yeah. All right. Break that down for me.
Yeah. So Lina is an old friend, and I worked with her extensively when she was the chief HR officer at Unilever. And we were on a panel in Davos together, and it was the unveiling of a report that we had co-authored called HR 4.0. And in the report, you know, we talked about as work is shifting, right, as this need for improvisation is growing, mm-hmm. you know, in the old days when everything was in a box, we could count on these rigid lines and hierarchy and structure as the way for organizing those boxes, right? If you're my boss, I would report to you. You would report to someone else. There was this nice, perceived at least, hierarchical structure where everything was nicely ordered. You know, you had the silent running of the enterprise, right?
Yeah.
No variance, everything in a compliance and control model. But increasingly, as work starts to escape these traditional boundaries, as it must to respond to the velocity and volatility of change, you know, what we need is different control. Control is maybe not the right word, but different mechanisms for alignment is maybe a better word, better phrase. And she had this quote as we were talking about this. She said, you know, in the old days, we could count on structure. But, you know, today, what we need is something different to align the disparate interests of an open ecosystem for work. And this is where culture really becomes the new structure. The culture being the thing, the norms, the behaviors, the skill sets, the mindset, the tool set, if you will, that aligns disparate interests around a common mission and purpose that enables the organization to fail fast and recognize that failure is not fatal, but essential for growth and future prosperity.
So it's interesting, just a little story. You know, we got sold, Second City got sold and went through mm-hmm. COVID and, you know, all this stuff. And there are very few of us left from the old guard. I'm one of the few. And I work in what is now called Leadership Row. So this is all the leaders of the organization. And it's traditionally this little wing has been that. And it used to be right in the, as you walked in the doors, we had all the headshots of the current talent. So the two resident companies, the three touring companies, their pictures are up there. At some point, though, when we came back, that got taken down. And there's just a photo of the Second City banner. And it always struck me, I'm like, why did that happen? And increasingly it's sort of bugged me. And I've mentioned it a few times, and we had this creative retreat. So the heads of the creative, of which I am, led this meeting with leadership group. And I brought this up. And I brought this idea. I said, you know, look, I love data, but I'm not a data guy. I'm very interested in AI, but I'm not, this is like laughable in terms of me fooling around with this stuff. But I have been here for 37 years and run the creative side of the business. And I think if you put those headshots back up, you would send a signal of belonging, a signal of meaning. And a light bulb must have gone off, because when I walked in this morning, they're back up.
And
that's this bringing together of like that. I don't have data for that. And we should that. But it is all of us talking to each other. Legacy, yeah. New, all those things that is where this work goes. And yeah. that's a lot of unlearning.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that one of my favorite quotes, and you probably saw this in the book, Kelly, is that Alvin Toffler quote, right, from 1970, where in his book Future Shock, he says the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who can't read and write. It'll be those who can't learn, unlearn, and relearn. And it is such a perfect metaphor for the times we live in, because the velocity of that unlearning, you know, learning and relearning has only increased exponentially.
Absolutely. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yeah, I do. So I think the question is, you know, where would there be a situation where I would have normally said no, but said mm-hmm. yes, and what happened? So, it was, I think, in about 2010, and the organization that I worked for, Towers Perrin, had just merged with another organization called Watson Wyatt, and I was had been leading a large business and was asked to lead a combined business. So incredibly busy time. And my wife said this to me before, but she came back and she said, you know, I really think it's time for you to write a book. I'm like, initially I was like, oh my gosh, like really in the middle of all this. And so, you know, normally I would have said no, but I had just come off helping the gentleman who would become my co-author, John Boudreau, with his previous book, helped him source a couple of case studies that I'd worked on. And she said, you know, you and John should really talk about writing a book together. And I was like, yeah, I'll think about it. And then, you know, I said, yeah, I think you're probably right, you know. And so you know, we ended up, so I said yes. And what that's led to is that one book that we started writing in 2010, you know, 13 years later, you know, we published the book in 2012. So 12 years later, you know, John and I ended up writing four books, and I've written six books. And, you know, that one sort of nudge, right, was just opened up a world that I could never have contemplated.
I love it. The book is called The Skills Powered Organization. Robin Jesuthasan, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly.
Getting the SN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.